Well, we can get started. Welcome to the physics series of talks this semester. We have a few more talks to go. We're going to be having next week a film producer, physicist, John Rubin, who actually went to MIT to be a physics major, got the physics major, but was seduced, was enlightened, was coaxed into the MIT film degree, and he's become, he's the head of a film production company, so that's next week. And today our speaker is the, well, someone I've known for quite some time, almost 30 years, Dr. Ed Berger of Argonne National Laboratory, a well-respected, renowned, famous, theoretical particle physicist, who's going to be talking to us today about searches for new physics at the energy frontier.
Thank you, Nick. It's a pleasure to be here. I can't really say whether I've ever been in Kansas before, but I'm trying to figure that out at lunchtime. Closest I'm making me grimace already. Because when I was a postdoc, I was off on the West Coast, and my brothers and mother lived on the East Coast, and so I would drive back and forth. I might have driven through the state, but I can't really be sure. At any rate, good to be here. And when I got this assignment, I didn't realize what I was getting myself into, because on a daily basis, I work on some little piece of particle physics, some little piece of the calculation, and I tend not to think of the field as a whole. So what I tried to do is to step back a little bit and think about what some of the bigger questions are that we're trying to think about and what I know about them. So I have no idea whether I'm talking at the right level, but I hope so. In any case, this is a small enough group so that we can have a conversation. So I went too fast. All right. No, what's happened here? Did I skip a slide? There we are. So the standard model of particle physics is based on these three generations of quarks and leptons. Quarks up here and the leptons down there. And these force carriers, the photon, the gluon, the Z boson, and the W boson. And in addition to these particles, we have a basic symmetry group, the SU3 symmetry of the strong interactions, and the SU2 left cross U1 electroweak symmetry breaking, which is spontaneously broken to quantum electrodynamics, about which I'll have a little more to say later. Now, the standard model of particle physics, embellished as it is with all of its mathematical structure, fits all of the facts, fits all of the observations remarkably well. So, there's a sense in which the story is complete, almost. But when a particle physicist looks up at the night sky, she's unhappy. She has lots of other questions in mind. Like, are there undiscovered principles of nature that we haven't found yet? New symmetries, new physical laws. She knows about dark matter, and she wants to know whether that has anything to do with the standard model. Can we make it in the laboratory? We know about neutrinos now, but they have mass. We want to know what the neutrinos are trying to tell us about anything else going on. Extra dimensions of space. Are there only three? Are there 11, as suggested by some string theories? And what about unification of forces? We have the unification of the weak in the electromagnetism, in the electroweak theory, but what about the strong interactions? Get that somehow unified with these other two. And what about gravity? off there in space all by itself. And why do we have so many different kinds of quarks and leptons? And why are their masses the way they are? And dark energy. What's it got to do with the standard one? All that. So those are the questions that the standard model doesn't address. And we want to be able to answer them somehow. And one of the places where we're looking for further understanding is at the energy frontier. High energy physics, by definition, has to do with higher and higher energies. And we make accelerators of ever-increasing energy, which means microscopes that probe deeper and deeper to smaller distances. So what are we hoping to learn? Now, among all of those important questions which I listed in the previous transparency, at the energy frontier are immediate questions that have to do with the nature of electrically symmetric breaking, the origin of mass. Is this mechanism, which I'll tell you about in a few minutes, having to do with the breaking of electrically symmetric, is it actually verified by the experiments that are being done at the energy frontier? What about dark matter? Do we make it in the laboratory? Is it the same dark matter that is observed by cosmological experiments? And I think most important, if we go to the energy frontier, we want to find something random. We want to find something that breaks, something that we can't predict or haven't predicted or should have predicted but didn't yet. Right? And my favorite example, probably dates me, has to do with the discovery of the James Lie in 1974. Right. By all rights, the theories we had at the time knew about the charm. They knew about this extra flavor, but somehow people hadn't put it all together in the right way and hadn't realized that these charm particles combine charm after charm to make a very narrow state called the Japes Eye. So when the Japes Eye was found at Brookhaven and at Stanford in 1974, people were totally amazed. And very smart people wrote totally wrong papers about what it is, but it turned out not to be. Okay, so my fondest dream is that we find something that nobody's thought about yet. The energy frontier is represented by this accelerator in Geneva on the Swiss-French border at Zurich. It's this machine that's buried underground. I forget how many stories below ground it is. I think it's about 17, what is it, kilometers circumference? I guess it's circumference diameter. Anyway, it's big. And it's underground. And there are these experiments that sit deep underground. There's the Atlas experiment. I'll show you a picture of it in a minute, which is it sits near the CERN site on the border between Switzerland and France. This is a general purpose detector studying all the particle interactions. There's LHCb, which is focused on heavy flavor physics. There's CMS, which is another general purpose detector way out in the French countryside near a town in which I lived for a while, called Belzine. And then there's the ELISE detector, which is right near the Jura Mountains. This one is focused on Fermi ions, the collision of heavy ions. So there are these four experiments which are operating at the present time. Let's look at a picture of two of the detectors. I have to learn to operate this machine. All right, so it was the right slide. I just forgot about it. So the machine itself is operating famously well at this point, colliding 3.5 TeV 8 protons against 3.5 TeV protons, so 7 TeV less than our mass. Here's a picture which reproduces the one I had on the first transparency. Picture of the magnets in the accelerator. It's a very difficult startup period. It's supposed to start up at 14 TeV. Had some problems with the magnets, and they were repaired well enough for it to be operating at 7 TeV, so no mass energy. So here are pictures of the two major detectors. I won't say much about the detectors because they're pieces of experimental equipment which are too complicated for me to figure out. But here's a band here so you can get some idea of the scale of this smaller detector, the compact muon spectrometer. And over here is the Atlas detector. Now, I've actually been under this detector. I've stood under it. And by the way, Dick, our friend Bob Stanek took me under this machine and had me climb up on the inside of it. And so I have this detector from inside. To get an idea of the scale, you see all of these ladders here. Well, they're actually staircases, and so you can count the number of stories, typical stories, let's call these each 10 feet stories. So you get an idea of the dimensions of this device. Okay, so the detectors are working well. Each one of them has analyzed more than one inverse femtobarn of data as of the present time. They had something like 5 inverse femtobarns delivered, and they've analyzed one so far, and I'll be talking about those results. So what's a femtobarn of data and inverse femtobarn? So I want to give you this one slide, which is an aside on luminosity, which is a word that's used in collider experiments. So the event rate, R, you know what an event rate R, because numbers of events that you collect, right, is the luminosity times the interaction cross-section, where in a collider environment, the luminosity is a product of the frequency of these. You have two bunches, each carrying N1 and N2 particles, protons, and they're colliding head-on, and F is the frequency with which the collisions occur. So the luminosity is the product of frequency times the number of particles per bunch divided by the transverse dimension of the beams, the product of the X and Y dimensions of the beam. So you can understand that if you make the beam smaller, you make the luminosity bigger. If you increase the number of particles in the bunch, you make the luminosity bigger. If you increase the frequency, you make it bigger. So with an equation like this, you know exactly what you have to do, if possible, in order to get higher and higher luminosity. We measure luminosity in units of centimeters squared to minus 3, inverse centimeters squared times inverse seconds. The peak luminosity at the LHC in 2011 was 3.5 times 10 to the 33 centimeters, inverse centimeters squared per second. The designed luminosity that they hope to achieve eventually is about 10 to the 34. Now, that's instantaneous luminosity. Integrated luminosity is something you get by integrating the instantaneous luminosity over time. Now, the luminosity doesn't remain constant. When you put these particles into bunches and you collide them, luminosity falls off with time, and so luminosity decreases with time once you put all of this stuff in the machine. But the integrated luminosity with time is usually quoted as the inverse of the measure of a cross-section. Now, you know we measure cross-sections in millibarns, microbarns, picobarns, and so forth. And so the inverse of the measure of the cross-section is the way you state luminosity. Nanobarn, 10 to the minus 3 square centimeters, picobarns, 10 to the minus 36, femtobarns, 10 to the minus 39. We're aiming at cross-sections in this equivalent range. So you take a peak luminosity of 3.5 times 10 to the 33 and multiply by the standard number of seconds per year, which is 10 to the 7th, right? You can see that you'll get a femtobarn or more a year without too much difficulty if you've got a stable machine. So that's just an aside so that when I keep throwing around femtobarns and so forth, you can come back to the slide. Okay. So let's talk about the LHC. The LHC itself is colliding two beams of protons. The protons don't act as coherent entities. What collide are the constituents inside the protons. So what collide are the quarks and gluons of one proton and the quarks and gluons of another proton. These constituents don't carry the full beam energy. They carry some fraction of the full beam energy. And what I've written here is typically that the energy of the scattering is roughly 1/9 center of mass energy of the proton-proton collision. So something in the order of 1 to 2 TeV, if I had a 14 TeV collider. Now, it's only approximately that because the distribution of energy of the constituents in the proton is very broad. Gets the peak at low values of the constituent momentum, but has a tail that goes all the way up to 1. So if you want to make something really rare, you try to operate on the tails of the distributions. And so in principle, you could produce lots and lots of mass, but you will produce it with a correspondingly reduced rate. All right, so I just described what's on this little block of information here, namely that we've got this broad of constituents and they collide. You can make all kinds of stuff. Now, in 2010, there was a good physics find. There was a superb run in 2011, which is over at the present time, delivered more than 5.5 inverse Hunter moments to the two major detectors. They're still running at the present time, but they're running for these heavy ion collisions in the LHC detector. They have a physics run planned in 2012, next year, at perhaps the same energy as this year, namely 7 TeV, although they could increase it to 8 TeV. There's some nervousness, right? If you wrap up the energy too much, you may break the magnets, and if you break the magnets, it's the end of the physics run, and so it's a compromise, and you stick at 7 TeV and get some guaranteed results, and you push it to 8 and risk breaking the machine for perhaps marginal gain. Anyway, I don't make those decisions. So they'll have a physics run in 2012, and it, based on this year's running, should be a very good physics run, maybe accumulating 20 inverse femtomons in 1 year. Then followed by a long shutdown for 2 full years, during which time they will repair some of these magnets that are still showing instabilities. The instabilities have to do with various welds that were made, and the welds aren't really doing very well. So in order to get the magnets ramped up to full energy, they're going to have to fix all of those welds. And they would like to get up to 14 TeV or 6.5 or 13 once the 2014 shutdown is over. So those are the collisions that are being examined. So let's talk about cross-sections for the moment. You gain a lot by going to high energy if you're trying to make very massive objects. You can see that the total cross-section doesn't change much when you go from, say, Tevatron energies up to LHC energies. The total cross-section is only increasing as the square of the logarithm of the center of mass energy. So total cross-sections don't change much. When you get a big increase in cross-section is when you're trying to make, so for example, 500 GeV in the center of mass, a Higgs particle, for example. Here you can see this red curve shows the expected increase from the Fermilab range up to the LHC range. Production of a pair of top quarks increases a lot. Production of a pair of, bottom quarks increases less because you're just making a smaller, is making mass, but that mass is a smaller fraction of the total center of mass energy, so you get correspondingly less increase of the cross-section. Now, I show you all of these calculated cross-sections. One of the things you have to do with the LHC before you worry too much about making something new is to make sure you understand what ought to be there. What ought to be there are all of the particles that we've produced at lower energies. What we've produced at lower energies are W bosons and Z bosons and jets of hadrons and produced photons, heavy quarks, like the bottom quark and the top quark. But we're producing them at a much larger momentum of that's possible at the LHC. So we want to make sure that we know how to calculate the cross sections and extrapolate them directly to the higher energies. All right, we do that with determinative quantum coordinate thermodynamics, the theory of the strong interactions. Right? So what we're going to do first, in order to make sure that we know what we're talking about in terms of making measurements, is to look at some of the results that have been published on the production of known states. So one of the things that we know about is the production of a jet of hadrons as a function of transverse momentum transverse to the collision axis. All right, so what is a jet of hadrons? Well, the way a theorist thinks about it is that in a collision between two protons, you're colliding a couple of quarks, or you're colliding quarks and gluons, or gluons and so forth, and in the final state, you're making a fundamental constituent, like a gluon or a quark. So how do you see that quark or that gluon in the final state? Well, you see it because it materializes as a jet of hadrons. It materializes as this narrow pencil of hadronic matter as a function of the transverse momentum. And so here are data which extend now, based on 37 inverse picoelements of data. There are cross sections that extend over 1 TeV in momentum transverse to the beam direction, and you see the data points as a function of the transverse momentum of the jet, and you see in these shaded bands the predictions that are made in quantum cohomology, including the uncertainties of the theory prediction. There are various theory uncertainties having to do with proton densities that I haven't told you about, that have to do with the strong coupling constant, that have to do with the order and perturbation theory of which you've done the calculation. And so this is considered to be very good agreement. And moreover, you don't see any radical departures here at the larger transverse momenta, at least within systematic and statistical evidence. Now, if you were to think back a little bit and ask yourself whether quarks have substructure, whether quarks really point like, or do they have stuff inside of them, you would see deviations out here at large transverse momentum eventually, because the scaling laws that apply in quantum chromodynamics are based on the notion of and the gluons, a point like. If you break the point like structure, you're going to begin to see deviations in these transverse momentum distributions. Obviously, we don't. So, the scale of something new in the strong interactions is clearly much bigger than 1 TeV. So, here's some more example of data. These are data on the production of W bosons in association with jets of hadrons. And what we can see here is good agreement with the theory out to transverse momenta of the jets of 300 GeV or so. Now the W itself is on the order of 100 GeV, right? The mass, 80 GeV object, so we're making lots of mass in the final state here. And the agreement with the production model is very good. So here's a summary of measurements that have been made and the comparisons with theory. W production, Z production, associated production of a W in a photon, Z in a photon, TT bar, a pair of top, or single top, WW, WZ, ZZ. Here are the data, and the red bands show the theory expectations. And just to give you a point of reference, if I had a Higgs boson of 130 GeV, the cross section would be in the range making that of 15 picoelements. We've clearly had measured cross sections at the LHC which are below that. So if there's a Higgs boson there, we've got enough energy to make. All right, so back to the questions now. pretty much by this point we know that we're supposed to, what we're supposed to see, we do see. We can extrapolate cross-sections from the lower energies successfully into the LHC energy. So the standard model is validated. And we're looking for something new in addition to the standard model. Now, it's important to validate. And why is it important to validate? Because new stuff decays into old stuff. If you're going to see something new, you're going to see it as a deviation in the momentum distributions of the old stuff. Now, the W boson, to give you a point of reference for just W boson, decays into an electron and a neutrino. You don't see the neutrino. Visible, you see the electron. You know what to expect if you don't have a W distribution in the momentum distribution of electron, because you know all of the stuff that makes leptons, and it gives you a distribution in lepton transverse momentum that falls off. If you have a W makes a lepton with about 40 GeV of momentum. So in the lepton momentum distribution, you see a peak. And so when you want to find the W, you look at the momentum distribution of electron and you find a bottom. It's as simple as that. You find a shoulder, right? You don't necessarily know the mass of the W, but you're looking for a shoulder and you ground on the tail of the electron momentum distribution and you find something. And that tells you that you produced an object. All right, so that's why we did these measurements. I didn't do them, the experimenters did them, to validate that the standard model works. And now we can start looking for something new. So what we're going to look for first is this so-called Higgs boson. So let's talk a minute about the electroweak standard model and where the W, where the Higgs boson fits in. All right, so we have this underlying symmetry group, the SU2 of the strong interactions, the SU2 of the U1 of the electroweak interactions. So under the symmetry, this is a perfect symmetry, right? And so in this perfect symmetry, the force carriers are all massless. The W, the Z, the photon, they're all massless. Now you know the weak interactions are characterized by a large mass scale. And so the W and the Z, control weak interactions can't be massless. They have to be massive objects. The triumph of the electroweak symmetry breaking notion is that it can somehow unify the electromagnetic and weak forces and produce predictions for the W mass and the Z mass, plus all kinds of other stuff. All right, so how does that work? Well, this slide is a summary of a good piece of a field theory course. So, I can only try to say the words. I can't teach you the course in one slide. But so in the standard model, you have these three left-handed doublets, electron neutrino, the muon and centrino, and the tau and centrino. Right, they transform under SU2 as left-handed doublets, and you have these right-handed fields. Then in this minimal standard model, you have also a complex Higgs doublet. It's a scalar doublet, which is only thrown in order to generate the mass. Then you turn on spontaneous symmetry breaking, and then marvelous things happen. The W boson acquires a mass. The Z boson acquires a mass. The photon stays massless. And the fermions develop an interaction with this Higgs field. And this field H is a simple scalar resonance that's the only remnant of this complex Higgs doublet. Right, so H is the physical neutral Higgs scalar. The coupling of the Higgs boson to these left-handed fermions is given right here. It's G times the mass of the fermion divided by twice the W mass. That is the mechanism that generates not only the mass for the W and the Z boson, but it's also the mechanism within the standard model that generates the mass for the fermions. It's So there it all is. And the question we are going to try to address here is the mechanism validated. Can we do a series of experiments at the energy frontier to verify that this simple picture is the right picture for breaking electroweak symmetry and generating the mass? Now, what do we know about the Higgs boson before doing any experiments at the LHC? One thing we know is that if the Higgs boson is this simple Higgs boson of the standard model, that there's an upper bound in its mass. You get the upper bound on its mass by looking at WW scattering in perturbation theory. And so here we're doing scattering of W left against W left, and we have these three perturbative diagrams. If we just looked at these three perturbative diagrams without knowing that there was a Higgs boson around, we would find that the cross-section grows with energy and violates unitarity in the S-wave. In order to restore unitarity without knowing anything about the standard model, we can throw in a Higgs field. It's an imagined scalar which gives a contribution in the S channel and a contribution in the T channel. And by the process of adding these divergent diagrams to these divergent diagrams with the opposite sign, we get a restoration of unitarity. From these diagrams, and the fact that we have to maintain unitarity up to 1 TeV or above, we get a bound on the Higgs mass. So we get an immediate bound on the Higgs mass within the standard model, which is about 1 TeV. We do even better by looking at a whole series of precise electroweak measurements. They're called precision measurements. I don't know why that is, because precision is a noun. It should be precise, but it's the language in the field. All right, so I'll tell you in a minute how we get this bound. But the bound is given by this curve here. And the favorite value of the Higgs boson mass, according to these precise electroweak measurements, is less than 100 GeV. But data from the E plus E minus experiments at the CERN large positron electron collider tell you there's no Higgs below 114 GeV. So all of this region in yellow or mustard color is excluded. Experiments at Fermilab have also excluded this band, and I'll tell you how that band was excluded. And so even before you turn on the LHC, you know that the Higgs boson is above 114 GeV. And cannot be in this band that was excluded by data at the Telecom. Okay, so where did this elliptical region here come in the chi-squared distribution? Well, it comes from a whole series of measurements that earliest. I'll just mention here, I won't go into high precision measurements at a large electron-positron collider at CERN, at the Slack linear collider, at the Tevatron. About 17 measurements. And these 17 measurements get analyzed, and they give us a bound. And the reason they give us a bound is the following. Just look at the figure at the bottom here. Okay. You want to compute changes in the W boson mass that come from letting the W boson fluctuate into a top and an empty bottom. All right, so a diagram like this, in which the W gets a correction to its mass, a radiative correction to its mass, gives a contribution to the change of the W mass, which is proportional to the weak coupling constant times the square of the top mass. The Higgs boson comes in because these same sort of diagrams, in which you get radiative corrections to the Z and the W masses, from introducing a Higgs boson in the loop. So a Z boson comes along and fluctuates into a Z boson and a Higgs boson, which then goes back to the Z, will give you a contribution to the Z boson mass, which is proportional to the logarithm of the Higgs boson. All right, same thing here with a loop, where which is now Z fluctuating into a pair of Higgs's. Right? So you get radiative corrections in field theory to the mass of a W that are proportional to the square of the mass of the top quark, or to the logarithm of the Higgs mass. And that's the way you end up with that curve. Because all of these measurements, these precise measurements, for which you have numbers with uncertainties in the data, are influenced by the exchanges of W's. And because you can exchange a W, you can exchange these particles in loops, and therefore you can affect the measurements. Okay? So, geez, what have I done? Gone back to the beginning. All right, so I talk over. Okay, so told you about the upper bound on the Higgs mass. I told you about exclusion regions that come from precise electroweak measurements. And now let's talk about the Higgs boson. So we know something about where it can be. So how are we going to find it? Well, we're going to find it because we know almost too much about it, except its mass. Given the mass, we know its full width. And we know its branching fractions into a pair of photons, into tau plus, tau minus, BB bar, WW, ZC. We know all of the branching fractions, and we know the total width. We know also, in principle, how to compute all of the standard model backgrounds. Backgrounds that produce a pair of photons, a pair of taus, a BB bar pair, a W pair, a Z pair. So, the task is to find evidence for a deviation from the standard model by looking in all of these channels. We're looking for something in all of those channels which is not equal to what we expect in the standard model. Now, here are the production cross-sections. Again, we don't know the mass, but we know how to compute the cross-section as a function of the mass. So here are various diagrams in quantum chromodynamics that will make the Higgs. Here's a pair of gluons fluctuating through a top quark loop, making a Higgs. Here's a pair of gluons making a TT bar pair. The T and the T bar merge to form the Z, the Higgs, rather. And so you have a final state in which there's a T and a T bar and a Higgs. Here's a case in which a quark and any quark annihilate through the W or the Z, and in the final state you get the W or the Z and the Higgs gets brimstrolling down. And here's a case in which we have WW scattering, making a Higgs, where the W comes from radiating off incident quarks in the proton-proton collision. So we know the cross-sections. Here it is. Here's the cross-section for the Higgs as a function of the top of the Higgs. Here's the function. Cross-section for the Higgs as a function of the Higgs mass. Here's the cross-section from this weak boson fusion process. Here we are in associated production. And here we are in association with a pair of tops. So we know all the cross-sections. Branching fractions. I told you we know what the Higgs decays into. We know what its mass is. Here are the branching fractions into a pair of photons, Z photon, charm anti charm, glue glue, bottom anti bottom, WW, ZZ. And over on the right hand side, the same diagram except that it's expanded here to cover the range of 100 to 1,000. If you're down in the low mass region looking for Higgs, you look for Higgs into gamma gamma or BB bar. If you're in the medium mass region, you focus on the WW scattering final state. If you're in the high mass region, you tend to focus on a pair of Z bosons. The golden mode is when you make a pair of Zs, and each Z decays into an electron-positron pair. It's a golden mode because you can measure the momenta of every particle in the final state for 4 electrons, and you can measure the Z boson mass precisely for knowing the momenta of the electrons. Problem is the branching fraction is miserably small. ranging fraction of the zillions of a pair of photons of trace. So it's the golden mode, but you're paying a big price for the Klingons. All right. So the search strategies, I think I just talked to you about them. At low mass, you look for a pair of photons. Intermediate mass, you look for a pair of Zs or Ws. Let's look first at data on the production of a pair of photons. So we're down in the low mass region. We're looking for Higgs of a mass of 120, 130, or so forth, in which the Higgs decays into a pair of photons. Really, really tough electromagnetic calorimetry requirements, because you have to measure an isolated photon, measure the momentum of the isolated photon, and compute the invariant mass distribution of this pair of photons over an enormous background from quantum chromodynamics. You can test your vertex resolution, your mass resolution, by looking at Z bosons making a pair of electrons. You measure the momentum distribution of electrons rather well. The LHC, something I didn't tell you about, is that when you put lots of particles in these bunches in order to increase the luminosity, you also end up with more than one collision per cluster. Right? So you get these two bunches of protons that collide, and not only do you make one hard collision per cluster, you make lots. And here's an example of an event in which there are, I forgot the count for giving you thought, here are a bunch of collisions that all happen at the same time. Roughly the same. And what you had to do was pick this one out. This yellow one here, because they come color-coded, these photons, right? that's the one you're looking for. Right? And so you're looking now for a tough situation. And so you look at the data. I don't look at the data. People look at the data. People don't know what they're doing when they look at data. They look at the cross-section, compare the cross-section with the expectation, and do that as a function of the Higgs mass. And here we are in the ATLAS experiment, and here over here we're in the CMS experiment, and they have a black curve, which is the observed, call it the observed number of events, and then these bands of the standard model expectations. And if you had a signal, you would have a big deviation here, okay? A big spike where the observation exceeds the standard model expectation. And so what you see here are some interesting peaks, but the locations of the interesting peaks differ in the two experiments. So in the usual sense of doing two experiments to get corroboration, you don't have it. Right? So you see some fluctuations down by a factor of two, you see some fluctuations up by a factor of two, you see some small excesses, but they don't yet confirm each other. They don't have signals at the same point. And so at this point, we don't have a Higgs discovery. I saw a flash of light and I wondered if it was shining this laser in my whole face. Anyway, they give me a better warning than that. All right, so let's look at Higgs into a pair of W's. W's. A lot of ways to see W's. W's decay weakly, they can decay into a pair of tops, they can decay here into a pair of lepton neutrinos. You can have one W decaying into a lepton neutrino, the other W decaying. Anyway, this is a mode that's particularly interesting for lots of reasons. In the final state, you see two hard leptons, for example, E plus E minus, or U plus mu minus, or U plus E minus in the final state, plus lots of missing energy carried off by these neutrinos. So in principle, the signal in the final state is good. Reasonable rate, request two leptons. Missing transverse momentum. We talk about transverse momentum because it's hard to measure accurately the longitudinal momentum, so we focus on the transverse dimension. You've got this missing transverse momentum carried off by the neutrinos. You can also do things because the Higgs boson is a scalar. It's decaying into two vectors, two massive vectors. These massive vectors decay into lepton neutrino by a V minus A interaction, which is well known. V minus A interaction throws the leptons either in the same direction of the W or opposite the direction of the W. And therefore, you can look at angular distributions in the final state between two of the leptons and pick a region of phase space which accentuates the scalar signal relative to the background. All right, so these sophisticated analyses are done. And what's the result? The result, I think, is on this transparency. If I can go backwards, here we are. Here's a summary of the data as of August this year. We have on this transparency lots of curves, which are difficult maybe to figure out in a couple of minutes. But anyway, what you see is the observed solid lines and the expected dashed lines for both Atlas and CMS. All right? There are bands here, shaded bands, which show you the regions in which both experiments agree that there's no signal. A signal means we're looking for some big excursion in the positive direction here of the cross-section observed relative to the standard model expectation of no signal. So we're looking for something, maybe a positive excursion in this region below 155 GeV, or in this region maybe 200 to 270, or above here, right? But these two regions, the shaded regions, are the additional regions of exclusion of the Higgs boson based on the data from the LHC at the present time. All right, so summarized on this transparency, I think it's obvious, right? You haven't read about it in the New York Times yet, or on CNN, so the Higgs boson hasn't yet been found. Right? So what we can do with the data so far is to exclude certain regions, 155 to 206, 295 to 450. Those are the exclusion regions now. Interesting hints emerge. For example, if you go back to the previous transparency, maybe both experiments agree that there's a little bit of interesting activity around 144. I wouldn't lose sleep over it yet, but it could be there. All right? Haven't given up yet. Haven't found it yet, but no reason to give up, especially the possibility that there's a Higgs boson in the range of 120 to 150. What else? Can't be the whole story. Higgs boson is not the only reason we built the LHC. We're hoping for dark matter. I don't want to talk about dark matter yet. I want to talk about another symmetry, possibility for the symmetries. I want to talk about possible motivation for supersymmetry from the point of view of the measurements we just talked about. So that gets us into another one of these field theory problems that underlies a lot of the theoretical thinking that has to do with predicting new particles. So we've got a fundamental scalar, this Higgs boson, and there's nothing that protects its mass. There's no fundamental symmetry that tells you that this Higgs boson mass is immune from radiative corrections. In fact, there are radiative corrections. If you consider the interaction of this Higgs boson with a pair of top quarks, or if you consider the interaction of this Higgs boson with a pair of W's, the correction to the Higgs boson mass will grow in proportion to whatever the cutoff is in your theory. So it's not stable. It's not required to stay where it is once you find it. All right? Now, obviously, if you find it, the mass isn't going to change the next day. It's going to be the same. Otherwise, you haven't found it. In any case, theoretically, there's nothing that stabilizes its mass, so you need something else in your theory that stabilizes the mass of this standard model. All right, so you go rummaging around and you try to find something in the textbooks that could do that for you. And so what you come across is supersymmetry, which has been around for a while as a theoretic construction. Its initial motivation, buried in the old literature, is to try to unify space-time symmetries, Poincaré Lorentz symmetry of space-time, with the internal symmetries. Internal symmetries have to do with things like isospin and everything else. So, in particle physics, supersymmetry does a nice thing for you. It relates fermions and bosons. It relates particles of different spins. It's going to have fermions and bosons, which can have spin 1 or spin 2. So, in supersymmetry, every partner has this superpartner of equal mass, with different intrinsic spin. And what's interesting, from the point of view of what we've been, just been talking about, is that supersymmetry does a nice job of stabilizing the Higgs mass. And why is that? Well, we look at a couple of diagrams here. Here's a diagram in which the Higgs mass fluctuates into a top and detop quark, and then gets a contribution to its mass proportional to the square of the mass of the top quark, and therefore grows. However, in supersymmetry, we have something called top with a twiddle on it, stop, a supersymmetric top. This object is a scalar, has the same mass as the top, but because it's a scalar, it comes into this loop correction with a different sign, a minus sign. And so as long as the top and the stop don't have masses which are too different, you can cancel the divergence in this diagram with the divergence in that diagram and restore a stability of the Higgs mass. All right, so that's the idea, that's the mechanism that supersymmetry gives us. Now, supersymmetry does a lot of other good stuff, but I'm just going to introduce it here from the point of view of stabilizing the Higgs mass. Now, it should come as no surprise to you that supersymmetry has been found. Had it been found, we would already know, because we would already know that we have twice as many particles as we've observed. So it hasn't been found. So it's a broken symmetry. We're used to dealing with broken symmetries in physics, not just in particle physics. We have lots of different models that tell us how supersymmetry could work. We don't have any fundamental theory of supersymmetry breaking. We have models of how you break symmetry. Now, here's one particular energy level diagram that you can get out of a particular model of supersymmetry breaking. Here are the sleptons, the supersymmetric particles of the electron and the gluon and the tau. Here are the squarks, the supersymmetric partner, the top squark, the bottom squark. Here's the supersymmetric particle partner, gluon, it's a gluon. The energy scale here, take it or leave it, it's just one particular model of supersymmetry. There are skeptics in the audience, or there should be. This is a construction at this point, which needs experimental failure to hang itself on. But it's one of the things we're looking for. The minimal supersymmetric standard model is a particular model of supersymmetry breaking. In that model, we introduce another conservative quantum number, which is called the R-pair. It's a quantum number that tells you that these supersymmetric particles are odd under a symmetry where standard model particles are even. And once you introduce that symmetry, then you necessarily have to make these supersymmetric particles in pairs, And in addition, when they decay, there's always a supersymmetric particle at the end of the chain. So when this supersymmetric object, this spark or this gluino or something, decays down, it ends up with a lowest mass supersymmetric particle, which is called the lightest, the LSP. This LSP is, in most models, neutral. Because it's neutral and doesn't interact with anything, it goes undetected. Right? And stuff that's undetected is missing energy. If its mass is big enough, then it can be a candidate for dark matter. So a lot of the excitement underlying supersymmetry has to do with the fact that supersymmetry produces, quote unquote, right, a natural candidate for dark matter. It's an object that can be produced in the laboratory that may be related to the dark matter that's seen in the night sky. Or not seen in the night sky, as the case may be. All right, so we're looking for supersymmetry. Now, I mentioned that in these decay chains, something happens at the end of the decay chain where you make a supersymmetric particle that's neutral, doesn't interact with anything, doesn't interact with photons, for example, so you can't see it with high electromagnetic radiation. It doesn't interact with the strong interactions, so you don't see it in terms of any kind of QCD. So this lightest supersymmetric particle does like a neutrino does, except that it's much heavier than a neutrino. It leaves missing energy. So if you're looking for something like a supersymmetric signal, you're invited to look at file states in which there's a lot of missing energy. Now, I mentioned before that you don't want to look at missing energy in the longitudinal direction along the beam lines, because your detectors tend not to be complete in the forward and backward regions. And so, in order to measure something missing, you're measuring the transverse dimension, right? And particle theorists have adopted this unfortunate language of missing transverse energy. We don't know that energy isn't a vector, but it's the crude language, the wireless language. So we talk about MET, missing transverse energy. We talk about an object which has E sub T with a slash through the E, which is missing transverse energy. It's really missing transverse momentum. Right? So we're looking for something with missing transverse momentum. We can make lots of final states. We can make jets with missing transverse energy, particles, final states in which it's a single lepton plus missing transverse energy, opposite sign dielectrons, same sign dielectrons, more than two or three leptons, and so forth and so on. You look at lots of final states in which the distinction is, from the standard model, that there's too much missing transverse energy. If you know the standard model very well, you compute the transverse energy distribution to an axe eyebrow. You know your detector very well, and so you know detector resolution effects. You know how much these detector mismeasurement errors and so forth contribute to missing transverse energy. So in principle, for any final state, you know how to measure, you know how to compute and measure the transverse energy, the missing transverse energy distribution, and you're looking for a deviation. All right, sounds simple. That's the way you find supersymmetry. Now, lots of analyses have been done. And, you know, if we had found supersymmetry, I would just show you that analysis and talk with you, right? We would have found it. We haven't found it yet, so what I'm going to do is pick one particular final state. We're going to look at one particular final state, and that would be our example of a search for a supersymmetric. We're going to be looking for leptons in the final state, which could be signals for a neutral eno decay, or a charge eno decay into a charge lepton plus another charge eno. And as I said, the discovery means an excess in some kinematic variables, not just one after all. We've got to find correlated excesses in different variables in the same function. But we're looking certainly for some deviations in the missing transverse energy distribution that is not accounted for by the missing energy associated with Z decay or W decay or top decay, to name a few sources. All right, so this is a very nice paper. I really recommend this paper because there are so few, to be honest with you, so few papers that I read that I think are really well written as well as good physics analyses. I'm sorry to say that, but I don't think my colleagues in particle theory or experiment do a very good job of writing. I think these people did an extraordinarily good job, not only of writing, but of analyzing data and making the analysis understandable. So here it is. Here's the reference, a very recent paper. Was an atlas study done of exactly two isolated electrons plus a missing transverse energy. And what they're plotting here is the dielectron invariant mass distribution, the invariant mass distribution of the two electrons, plus they're calculated and measured both, because you calculate your background, but you want to validate your calculation against the data in order to be sure that you know what you've got. So they've actually compared their data to the backgrounds, and they see no deviation whatsoever. And here, what they show here is a plot of the data divided by the theoretical expectation. So they have no excess over the standard model. They're looking for some evidence of supersymmetry. In order to take these data, which they have no signal, and convert it into a statement about supersymmetry, you have to work within a certain context for supersymmetry breaking. So they do that. And within this particular limited model, they are able to tell us that there's no direct evidence found yet, and the data imply that if there is a Giorgino, its mass is above 200 GeV. Giorgino is a supersymmetric particle of one of the GH bosons. All right, so Giorgino masses are excluded up to 200 GeV. There are other data which are analyzed together to tell you that the Marino mass is about 400 GeV. No evidence for Suzy. But what I find troubling when I read all of these supersymmetry papers, and I'll just share it with you, is that it would be good to be able to abstract from all of these searches a physics statement that tells me that if there is supersymmetry, then the mass scale of supersymmetry is above some number. Right? Unfortunately, you can't do that yet because there's so much model dependence in the models of supersymmetry breaking that you're not in a position to say from all of the different analyses that are done that the scale of supersymmetry, if it exists, is above 300 GeV or 400 GeV or 600. I would like to know, if there is new physics of the supersymmetry in nature, what's the scale? Above what scale do I have to wait? Do I have to go in order to see? We don't have an answer to that question yet, but I think that's the question out there. We haven't seen it yet. It means that among all of the channels that I've looked in, I haven't been lucky, or it means that it doesn't exist, right? But I'm not able to say yet what the story is. All right. I focused on supersymmetry because I think within the context of the Higgs search, it's probably the closest relation relative. There's a lot of other stuff out there that theorists imagine because experimenters haven't set them straight yet. All right. As I say to my experimental friends, it's your job to put us out of our misery. Set the course. Tell us what we ought to be thinking about instead of all of this stuff. extra space dimensions, Kellett-Technicolor, the strong dynamics. Well, look, if there's no Higgs all the way up to 1 dB, then strong dynamics is a good candidate for explaining what's going on. Little Higgs, no Higgs, hidden valley. Completely outside the context of Higgs physics entirely. Electro quarks, fourth generation, heavy tops and bottoms, heavy neutrinos, extra gauge bosons, W prime, C primes that don't have any particular coupling to the standard model electrons. They only couple to third, fourth generation. Okay. So there's a lot of other physics that is being explored at the LHC, and so far, nothing. Doesn't mean there is nothing. They've only done an analysis of one inverse femtobarn. And so we're going to see a lot from the data. Here's an example of something that is not predicted by any of your theory friends. Suppose you're looking for an object which decays into a pair of jets. How would you find that? Very heavy object. You look for a pair of jets in the final state. You plot the invariant mass distribution. You compare it with your QCD prediction. You go all the way out to 3 and 4 TeV, and you don't see any deviation. So what you can say, just by looking at this distribution, if there's an excited quark, its mass is about 4 TeV. If there's an axial gluon, it's way out there in the tail. The gluon that we know in QCD, right, is a vector. It's not an axial vector. Color octet scalar resonances, they're all above that mass scale. That you can learn just by making a very nice measurement of the invariant mass distribution of a pair of jets. So that's a nice measurement, right? Dark matter. I mentioned dark matter already and the possibility of the neutralino and supersymmetry being in dark matter candidate. We really would like to make the connection, right, between cosmos and the laboratory. And this is sort of an appealing place to do it. In the laboratory, we've got a big leg up, because if you do find dark matter, you can really study it. And just as ordinary matter doesn't come in only one flavor, there's going to be a whole spectrum of dark matter things. So what the dream is to identify a dark matter component and to study it at the others. All right, so I'm a little bit over time here, so I'm going to skip a few slides. Here's where I want to, probably the next to last slide. The questions are intriguing. I tried to list them early in the talk. All the questions that we're motivated to ask, given that the standard model works altogether too well. There are connections among the questions. Dark matter is one of the connections. We have the experimental tools, we have the technology, we have the strategies. Present time, I think it's fair to say the low-lying fruit's been picked. We've been through the apple orchard. Personally, I like pears better than apples, but we've been through the vineyard, and we've been through the vineyard. Yeah, I used to like grapes too. I still do until they're fermented. We picked the low-lying fruit, tastes good, but we haven't found any surprises. Rich physics program's underway. We're going to have another 5 inverse femtobarns analyzed in March. And then there's all of next year's running, another 25 inverse femtobarns. I think by the end of calendar 2012, March of 2013, we've got to see anything new and start to work. Really tough to work. I think at the present time, and I try to say this to my younger colleagues who are terribly depressed, I say, yeah, you've got to be patient with this machine that's barely turned on. We're too impatient with what we want to find. Anyway, this will be the last line. There's a lot of other stuff going on in particle physics. I talked about the energy frontier. The energy frontier involves things like the Tevatron, the LHC, the LHC upgrade. We know about experiments having to do with cosmic rays, which really reach much higher energies. There's Auger, there's Planck, there's the large synoptic space telescope. Did I get all those letters right? Right. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on. WMAP blasters are operating at the present time. We've got B factories. We've got a whole exciting neutrino program going on with T2K and NOVA and double beta decay. Catalan, really long dark matter searches. Lots is going on. In the short term, by the short term I mean mid-2012, I think we'll have a much clearer picture about the exclusion region for the Higgs boson. It might have been founded by next summer. And I think, was it somebody told me today, that, I guess you did, right? You told me that there's been confirmation from Double Show.
The
third mixing of it. So I'm looking for a good confirmation of the large value of the third mixing angle that was measured by T2K, because I think that will really help set the direction for neutrino physics. We know the value of that third mixing angle is good precision. We'll have a good idea about whether we can fly a neutrino program that involves looking for CP violation in the neutrinos. I think if we found the Higgs boson with a mass in the range below, say, 150 GeV, we could entertain the possibility of building a Higgs factory in the U.S. Higgs factory would be a very precise electron positron collider, tuned in order to measure the Higgs boson with incredible precision. Not only do we find the Higgs boson and measure its mass with incredible precision, we could look at all of the branching fractions, which you cannot measure with the LHC, and find out whether it is the Higgs boson on the standard model, or whether there are deviations suggestive of what the new theory is. In any case, thank you very much. It was fun.
Questions, comments, discussions? We're open for ideas. Yes, we're going to try to collect the slides.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, because
if you're willing to share.
My pleasure.
Other ideas? You want to talk about? I mean, you list a lot of, you know, a lot of things there. There's a good, I mean, understanding the strong force a little better in the nuclear world, but that's outside of high energy physics.
I don't have much insight into that business. I made one foray not so long ago into nuclear structure physics. I was trying to understand particle distributions measured in the ground. Wrote what I think was a very, very good paper. With a nuclear theorist. I don't really have much insight into what I can learn from nuclear solutions.
Okay, yeah. Richard, what's the question? Well, you know, we have like different neutrinos could oscillate into each other. There's some chance of one going into another, so there's a mixing. And so you could describe it in terms of a mixing angle theory.
So in any case, the language is that the flavor eigenstates and the mass eigenstates are the same, all right? And so, you know, the mass eigenstate is quick. That's the object that has a certain mass. But that object is not a pure state of flavor. It's a mixture of the electron, the muon, and the tau. So there's this conversion between the mass matrix and the flavor matrix that involves a mixing. Those are the quantities that end up being measured in experiments like Camelot, see that the electron is given a neutrino. It's impossible. And so you end up measuring these beautiful quantities. Hank Hamlin has done a beautiful job in particular of pressuring the oscillation rate for the anti-neutrino that's produced in a nuclear reactor that oscillates into a neutrino reactor. So you start out in a nuclear reactor with an anti-electron neutrino, ends up in a detector and something else. So things are, the flavors are oscillating into one another. And so the mixing is described in terms of these angles. All right, now the third angle is the 1-3 angle. And beta have suggested until recently that it could be consistent with zero. Now, if you had a 3x3 matrix in which one of the mixing angles is zero, then you would have no CP violating phase. So the T2K experiment is the first to come up with a value of the third mixing angle that contains not zero. Statistically, not zero. It's important to confirm that. If you're going to define the neutrino program for the future, you would like to be able to define a program that is based on help you for that reason. That's the way I would.
Even though there's a new result you mentioned, it's still not like a 5-sigma effect.
Right.
It's
still
consistent with, it still could be zero.
Well, on my slide there, I see confirmations. Confirmation. Maybe I should have said establishment.
It's all debatable with statistics.
But what's nice about the experiments that are being run at the present time is that they have two detectors in which Thiel's way of looking at things is that the first detector really does a good job of measuring what kind of neutrino they have in the beam. And then the second detector tells you what neutrino you're observing after this long distance that's the distance between the first and second detector. So you have a gear detector, which is maybe your accelerator in the nuclear reactor. Then you have a far detector, very far away. So you measure with the first detector what the flux of the neutrinos is at different flavors, and then way down the line, you measure the flux for the flavors that have. So T2K had these two detectors and did a nice measurement. And the near detector was at the moment as a result of your one of the tsunami didn't put any water in it. The earthquake damage both times. So they're repairing the T2K detector, and then there's the double Charlemont experiment, which is in France, on the Belgian border, and they're operating at the moment with only one detector. They'll have a second detector here, that's in the near future. Then there's the big experiment in mainland China, not far from Hong Kong. Somebody remind me.
Taipei.
They have, on the mainland, I think they have four cores in this nuclear reactor complex. And the Chinese have spent a lot of money carving tunnels and mountains to build the detectors. So diabation, diabation.
Well, I don't know if we are out of time, but you've mentioned supersymmetry, and it seems like you are end up. But one of the reasons that motivates it is to cancel these infinities. Yeah. And as you mentioned, for that you need the breaking to be small for the supersymmetric partners to have about the same mass as the normal particles, and so we are starting to exclude, exactly the same mass. So how useful is supersymmetry at this point? How much heavier can we get before we need to see it, or it won't fulfill that need of canceling the infinities anymore?
Yeah, well, I would say that we have to see some evidence for supersymmetry below 1 TeV.
1 TeV. So that's, we have some room left.
The natural scale of supersymmetry is the weak scale, which is Isaac Jupiter, right?
So,
and so we're begging the question.
So nature will decide in the end, but what's your bet? Yes or no?
I don't leave my salary on.
That's a fair answer.
Yeah.
I'm concerned about Mother Nature's answers. Nature will decide.
Let's thank our speaker again. And we have a talk next week, don't forget. Thanks.